Welcome back to Highly Respected. I'm your host, Scott Greer. Today, I'm joined by American Identity Movement President and actually the movement CEO in general, Patrick Casey. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. I mean, it's hard to find you. You've been banished by big tech. It's very hard to find Patrick in these days. He's been cast out into the wilderness, roaming the streets where he can find. I mean, because they don't allow him on Twitter. They don't allow him on YouTube. Don't allow him on Patreon, PayPal, or anything. He's a real hunted man, our punished movement CEO indeed. But we got a lot of topics. We'll get to that in a moment. But first up, let's talk about the supposedly Marxist Black Lives Matter. Republicans and conservatives keep calling BLM a Marxist group. However, every corporation on earth supports BLM, and BLM doesn't appear to threaten capitalism at all. BLM seems to be more anti-white than anti-capitalism. Why do conservatives insist that BLM is Marxist and ignore its true nature?
I think that the average conservative, and I don't mean, I'm not trying to condescend here, doesn't really have a solid grasp of what constitutes Marxism. And as such, they see any remotely left-wing.
Dude, social... you just insulted all of my boomer fans. They're going to be pissed. Good luck.
Well, they better listen up.
Back onto Twitter now. But continue.
Well, I mean, I just, in short, I think that I can sympathize with and I understand why the average conservative would look at something that is destructive toward America and is antithetical to Western values and say that is Marxist. But what we're up against just in general is not Marxism. Black Lives Matter and you know, Jeff Bezos and George Soros, they're not trying to usher in the dictatorship of the proletariat. What we're up against is globalism or neoliberalism, and these ruling ideologies make use of certain Marxist perspectives and talking points, but it's for cynical economic and political gain. It's not actual. I don't think it's exactly what Karl Marx actually had in mind.
Yeah, and they always rely on the supposed founders of the movement. And it's like these three women, you don't even really know their names. Like, I can't even recall their names of who they said. And they said in like some video interview, they're like, oh, we're trained Marxists. And they're like, ha ha, this is it. This proves this is a Marxist group. Now, there is a positive to this. It does give Republicans and conservatives a reason to hate Black Lives Matter. As we've had people like Mitt Romney who are like, Black Lives Matter, I support it. And everyone's like, why don't you support Black Lives Matter? Do you not say that black, are you saying black lives don't matter? It's the same with like Antifa. It's like, oh, you oppose Antifa? So you're for fascism? You know, it's these very stupid rhetorical weapons that they use to like get people to support things that like, Black Lives Matter is not whether you say Black Lives Matter. And clearly our society thinks Black Lives do matter. In fact, they matter more than your life because, I mean, we're having nationwide riots and our whole social transformation because of one black guy who's a convicted felon, who's drugged up, having a heart attack. And also the worst genocide that's ever been perpetuated in this country is that 9 unarmed blacks died in the year of 2019. We cannot allow any unarmed blacks to ever die in this country, even if they're using a car to try to run over a police officer. You know, we cannot allow that. So it is one good thing is that it does say it's like, okay, it's a boomer conservative talking point, but at least they're showing opposition to Black Lives Matter. But it'd be so much easier to actually identify what motivates Black Lives Matter, and it's black supremacy. You know, it feels, as I was saying, that Black Lives Matter more than yours. That's the real message of the movement. And they're viciously anti-white. I mean, you can look at anything that they say. It's like whites are the evil villains. They've done the worst crimes in history, from slavery to colonialism. We must punish whites. They must give us reparations. It's like whites are inferior. Whites must shut their mouths and not say anything at their events. They must get on their stomachs and do I can't breathe in their act of atonement. It is an insanely anti-white, and it's based on the notions that whites, and even like, you know, whites can't, white communities are inherently evil. There's so many things that are just like, it's anti-white. I don't think the average Black Lives Matter person knows what Marxism is, much less who Karl Marx is. Definitely has never read those books. I'm sure even the founders can't even define what Marxism would mean. And it does give them like the right or the mainstream right, rather, a reason to oppose them. But they're so stuck in like the Cold War mentality is that they have to see everything as like communist versus freedom. And a lot of the people who are promoting this are Gen Xers and boomers who, you know, they grew up in the Cold War and they still think of communists as the ultimate evil. And, you know, communism isn't really a valid ideology anymore. It's on the dustbin of history that they have to continue to resurrect it to attack current enemies when it's really not the case here.
Yeah, I agree with basically everything that you said there. To the extent that
everyone should agree with everything I say.
Yeah, you told me before I come on the show, I have to agree with your take. So I'm just making it very clear.
You have to be like, great point, Scott. I have never heard
amazing,
that
amazing commentary. Yeah, well, I would just add on there. Yeah, to the extent that people in Black Lives Matter support socialism or Marxism, they support it just maybe in general because they think that they're going to get something out of it. Like, oh, socialism, I profit from that. But in terms of like Marxist theory and, you know, socialism defined as Marx and Engels would have defined it, I don't think that really plays much, if any, of a role in Black Lives Matter. As you said, it's absolutely defined by being anti-white before it's defined by being anti-capitalist. It's focused on identity politics. And, you know, this isn't a particularly groundbreaking take at this point, but the whole woke ideology really just serves to cover up what our elites are up to. And that is just, you know, destabilizing the country and consolidating power, money, and, you know, control for themselves. So all of this really serves to that advantage. Even if the people in Black Lives Matter aren't aware of it, the effect is the same.
Yeah. And it's, you know, one of the core features of Marxism is like its class-based analysis, and BLM is definitely not a class-based movement whatsoever. It's entirely racially based. They want a redistribution of wealth, not among the classes, but between the races. They want to redistribute white wealth to blacks. That's the whole point of reparations. And every other thing that they support is that it's redistributing wealth and privilege from whites to blacks. They don't care about the proletariat. They see working class whites as their primary enemy versus upper class whites. And most of the people who are joining in with BLM protests, they've seen, they've done a lot of studies on these polls about, you know, various protests in like Atlanta and everywhere where there's a majority of white people who are there during the day. And even in Portland, which we'll talk about later on the podcast, you know, I don't think there's any black people in Portland protesting. It's like entirely white, but it's all these like middle class, upper class whites who are joining in, and they don't feel that BLM is going to take away their wealth or take their property and abolish it. It's just entirely race-based. It's not anything about class war. It's all about race war for this movement. And, you know, going along with like conservatives always like, you know, still obsessed with Marxism and communism, now I always have to see is there's a little bit of controversy on the right over the term cultural Marxism. And when conservatives use it, they use it in an almost autistic fashion, like saying that like the Frankfurt School is the direct, you know, all these leftists are directly listening to Horkheimer and Adorno and Marcuse, and they're like, they've been plugged into the Frankfurt School, and there's this grand conspiracy that's been extending for almost 100 years with the Frankfurt School starting this off with cultural Marxism. And some people on the right are right to question and be like, a lot of this stuff seems more to emanate from Cold War liberalism and actually what we've seen mainstream liberals were promoting in the 1950s and 60s. You know, there was a great thread, which I tweeted out on Wednesday, by this liberal New Republic writer. I'm not even beginning to try to pronounce his name. He's an African immigrant who was showing off all these newspaper clippings from the 60s and 70s, where it was showing that these like very liberal publications were saying a lot of the same things that we're seeing in our current cultural war. And, you know, these were definitely not Frankfurt School trained Marxists or postmodernists or anything. These were diehard Cold War liberals who are like, white racism is a grand neurosis that we have to use countless hours of education and training to eradicate. And we're seeing a lot of that rhetoric today. I don't think, you know, cultural Marxism is a worthwhile epithet to say about the left, you know, it's like you're cultural Marxist. I think it's like fine to use it that way. But a lot of conservatives want it. They want to trace this whole ideological genealogy, and there's this grand conspiracy theory, and it all leads back to the Frankfurt School, when a lot of this stuff is rooted in the post-war order that liberals and even a lot of conservatives were supporting, and now it's gone haywire, and it's not really the fault of the Frankfurt School. Not that we support the Frankfurt School, but it's a little silly to see this a grand conspiracy theory.
Right, trying to pinpoint one very specific intellectual movement for, you know, and to blame that particular movement for all of the issues that we face today is a bit it's a bit reductionist, and it's, yeah, like you said, it's not even correct.
Yeah, and the Frankfurt School was not responsible for the worst excesses of the civil rights revolution. It was like liberals themselves, like the Warren Court were not Frankfurt School trained intellectuals. You know, they were standard issue liberals at that time. You know, Kennedy and LBJ were not Frankfurt School trained intellectuals. And same with like most of the people that, I don't think Obama, you know, they were always trying to claim like Obama's like a secret Marxist. Like, I don't think so at all. I mean, he's like a standard lib. And yeah. I think that like, it's not as exciting. Well, it's the same with the left. The left always has to call its opponents Nazis and fascists when like nobody is. It just excites their base more. But the difference is that in our society, Nazis and fascists excite more people or inspire more hatred than communists. I mean, communists is, it's growing to a point where younger generations don't have this, you know, the negative connotations that boomers, Gen Xers, silent generation, the older people have. Like, I mean, as a millennial, and, you know, we're fellow millennials, millennial identity movement here, you know, there's not like the negative connotations. It's like something that you saw in 80s movies. It's like, oh, well, they're villains, but they're not really around anymore. I guess they killed a lot of people. I mean, even with like people always like say that like they killed a lot of people, but it doesn't register in the same way that Nazi war crimes do. I mean, a large part because our education system, of course, teaches far more about Nazi war crimes, and there's far more movies about it. And people like say, like, you have to take these lessons today. These are very relevant to our current situation, when in a lot of ways they're not. They don't do that with communism. It's not pervasive throughout the culture. So a lot of people are complaining about communism. They really think that you're arguing about something anachronistic, even though it's the same with, you know, the left, you know, crying Nazi at everything that they don't like. In our culture, Nazi just carries more weight. It matters more to the culture. World War II is the grand historical event of our time. It's the only, in some ways, it's the only historical event that's ever happened, according to some pundits. And everyone tries to relate contemporary issues with what happened then. So it just carries more weight. And a lot of the right tries to use communists as a counter to that, and it doesn't work.
Well, you could, for all we know, Scott, you could be part of the cultural Marxist conspiracy, and you could be getting paid by Soros to
that's
cover
true.
Up.
That's true. That I could be getting Adorno paid to say that cultural Marxist. Well, Soros was inspired, as some people have pointed this out on the, he's like, his chief influence is Karl Popper, who was a liberal. He was definitely not a Marxist. Like, Karl Popper was a strong liberal, and that is, you know, the Open Society Foundation, that's named after a Karl Popper concept. You know, he was definitely not a Marxist at all, and he didn't, you know,
well, because
he
was a Nazi. Yeah.
Well, Soros is definitely Nazi.
Hold out his own people.
Yeah, that's they always, like, even with that, the right has to, even when they realize that they realize that communism doesn't carry the same weight, they just have to go to Nazi. It's like same, you know, they all say that Antifa are the real fascists, and they'll even put them with like, they're the succeeding organization of the Klan, because the Klan also wore masks. And I was like, a lot of people wear masks throughout time. You know, it's not, wearing masks isn't necessarily what makes them similar. You know, going on a similar topic about, you know, bad conservative or really dumb conservative talking points is that Republicans are finding a way to support statue destruction as long as the statues are of Democrats. One of the many conservatives who made this point is Texas Rep. Dan Crenshaw. Crenshaw tweeted Thursday that he is proud to support the removal of Confederate associated statues from the Capitol because they're Democrats and Republicans won the Civil War. this is historically brain dead because there was Democrats also fighting for the Union, and you know, it wasn't, and there was Whigs on the Confederacy. It's just very stupid. I think most of our listeners would agree with that. Why do Republicans always make these stupid arguments? I mean, we've seen this several times when, like, oh, the Democrats are trying to hide their racist history by taking down a Robert E. Lee statue. Ha ha, we got you this time. But nobody is convinced at all by this.
Yeah, I mean, what it is more, it's really just more of the same what we expect from conservatives at this point, and that is that they are looking for any excuse to rationalize going along with whatever insanity the left is at a particular point in time. And if they can spin it as actually this is a conservative thing to do, it's conservative to support these statues being removed, then that accomplishes a few things. A, it frees them from any responsibility to meaningfully oppose the left. And B, it allows them to feel as if they're the real progressives. They're with the times. And but I mean, the consequences is you end up trading your principles. You end up trading what actually matters, the things that you're supposed to be defending, for short-term, for electoral gains that may or may not, manifest. So it's,
yeah, I don't even think it's like for electoral gains. They're not clearly getting any electoral gains. Right. It is a way to rationalize these developments that they have no control over. Because if they were trying to defend this, they don't have a language or any rhetorical weapons to defend these statues besides, like, well, it's history. They can't really say, like, well, this is our heritage. They don't want to say that this is our heritage. They'll just say, well, like, people learn from history by seeing a Jefferson Davis statue. They don't want to say Jefferson Davis is a hero anymore. It's the same with the Mississippi, state flag when they were changing that. Republicans there who were proudly flying the flag and defending it then decided, hey, this Mississippi flag, which, of course, used to feature parts of the Confederate flag, well, this is a Democrat flag, and Democrats, we're now going to make a Republican flag. I was like, you idiots were like defending it 5 years ago, the same very people. And now they're trying to like do this like way of like, oh, it's actually a Democrat flag. And it's a way of, as you were saying, it's a way of rationalizing radical changes that they feel that they cannot counter or stop. And they're just trying to rationalize it as a conservative victory when it's not at all. It's basically saying that their constituents, grandparents, great grandparents are no longer welcome in contemporary America and that their heroes should be wiped away. And they're just saying, like, well, the Democrats are trying to hide it. There's a Republicans and conservatives have a kind of, it's like race realism, but the only two races are Republican and Democrat, and they're not changing. They're eternal archetypes. Like, Democrats in 1830 are the same today. That they're like, it's a timeless people, and you have not changed at all. They're the exact same people. Like, they really think that Nancy Pelosi's ancestors were the ones defending slavery and fighting in the Confederacy when she's like Italian. They weren't even here yet. And it's the same with several other Democrats. While they think that if you're like a Republican now, like, you embrace that, your people and that heritage, and now you're the direct descendant of Abraham Lincoln. And it's a very weird concept. And the left does not have this at all. The left does not have this type of idolatry for its own party. Like, they just view the Democrats as a useful vehicle for their own ideology and their own agenda items. Republicans actually believe that like the Republicans are a people that have been the same for generations. We must preserve a future for Republican children. it's something that defines you and your characteristics. And they've been unchanging since, the beginning of the Republic. While for Democrats and liberals, they're fine with praising like past dead Republicans, but there's, this real resistance among Republicans and conservatives to praise any past Democratic president or hero. And even when I was, I tweeted out today, I was saying that, people like Crenshaw would happily replace Thomas Jefferson. People were trying to say, no. Thomas Jefferson was a Democrat Republican. That's very different from Democrat. They cannot admit that any of the founders may have been Democrats, because that would wipe away their whole historical anthropology of American history.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of this they actually believe in. I'm sure many of them, at the very least, the naive, though likely well-intentioned supporters of people like Dan Crenshaw and others, and Dinesh D'Souza, right? Some of these people might actually buy into it, but I don't know if the people at the top who are promulgating this really, how much they buy into it. But yeah, it is very absurd, and it's just so insincere when you have, when conservatives don't have the backbone to say what they really think and to say what really needs to be said and to tell it like it is, then they end up right doing these rationalizations for going along with the left and this totally bizarre engaging in totally bizarre historicism to try to claim, you know, the Democrats are the real racists and stuff like that. I'm reminded of your tweet. What's his name? Madison Cawthorn. He was the young crippled candidate in
2024-25
Kentucky. Yeah. And he was talking about how the Democrats removing their own statues. And maybe I forget the exact tweet. It was something going along with the statue removal, calling, you know, these Democrat racists for doing that. And you pointed out, you know, this guy touts his, you know, multi-generational history in Eastern Kentucky. You pointed out that this guy's
Western North Carolina, and he likely been
his ancestors were totally Democrats.
Yeah, there, his ancestors were definitely Democrats, and people always make that. It's like, and Southerners are the weirdest ones about this, because even ones who like admire the Confederacy will also, you know, subscribe to this weird anthropology about the Democrats first, Republicans, everything bad was like Democrats. It's like, your ancestors were 100% Democrats if they lived in it, because like the Republican Party did not exist for the first half of the 20th century in the South. Like, unless you were Black, there's no way you were a Republican in like 1930 South. So like, your ancestors were definitely Democrats, or voting for Democrats at the least. And these idiots will just like say like, oh, the Democrats are trying to hide their history. It's like, no, it's your history that they're trying to hide. Like, there is no like secret Republican history for the South unless you're, you know, Black or we're a carpetbagger. And Madison Cawthorn has always insists that his like family has been there since, I believe, the Revolutionary era. So they were definitely Democrats. You know, I know my family was like in the South. They were Democrats. So maybe that explains how I'm so racist.
Wow.
It's like, yeah, the Democrat genes are coming in. You know, we'll have like they'll like hire a scientist to study Democrat genes to prove that it actually causes racism. You know, Democrats are it's science proves Democrats are more predisposed to racism. These are all ideas that they would see. It's so stupid, but it's a way for them to, you know, as we're saying, rationalize. It also gives them some way to, you know, totally resist the Democrats, but it doesn't convince anybody. And they still think that, like, telling Blacks that Democrats are the ones who supported slavery and secession and segregation and yada, 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 that'll convince them. And Blacks are just like, oh, well, like, that was like 100 years ago. Today is today. And Democrats give me more stuff than Republicans, so I'm going to vote for the Democrats. And this is an idea that hasn't really cracked into the skulls of conservatives and Republicans. But, you know, speaking of cracked skulls, you know, Portland right now is a war zone, and, you know, it's really causing a lot of controversy in our country. Antifa and BLM continue to assault the Portland federal courthouse every night and wreck downtown stores. Federal agents do battle with them instead of local police. This has prompted cries of fascism from libs and neocons, and everyone is going crazy that the fact that we would have federal agents trying to arrest and hitting with batons Antifa are trying to destroy a federal courthouse. Pat, what do you think of the Portland situation?
Well, it's not particularly surprising. We know that Portland and perhaps to a lesser extent Seattle, much of the Pacific Northwest, is defined by frequent recurring Antifa violence and destruction of property. Portland seems to be about the worst. There are other parts of the country where it's pretty bad too, but Portland definitely stands out. And yeah, I mean, amid all of the insanity of the last few months, it you know, it's you could forgive someone for not being too clued into every particular city, but when, you know, whereas with many cities, I would say most cities that have experienced unrest and perhaps mass violence and destruction of property in the past few months, most of those have subsided in the last few weeks. Portland continues to rage on. So it's really just more of the same up there. But it is particularly noteworthy just how long it's lasted and the fact that it doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon. And I saw that the Portland mayor Ted Wheeler got maced, he got hit by tear gas last night by federal agents up there when he was, I guess, they're protesting with the people destroying the city, trying to break into the courthouse.
Yeah, expressing solidarity with them. But the protesters kept harassing him and throwing bottles at him. And at one point that somebody, they're using leaf blowers to blow away the tear gas. And somebody put like a leaf blower in his face and began hitting him with it. And he had to retreat into like a city building with his like bodyguards like scuffling with the protesters to protect himself. And he went on about how like, oh, this was a totally peaceful protest. The federal agents caused this entirely. They antagonized these peaceful protesters. This is all the federal agents' fault, and this is bad. And then right after he interviewed, like all the protesters began throwing bottles at him, and he had to like retreat into a building and let his security detail deal with the protesters. And it's like these people, they could be stabbed to death by the protesters, and like with their like blood skirting out of their mouth, and like, well, this is Trump's fault. Like, they were peaceful protesters. Like, I was stabbed by right-wing extremists. Like, they cannot comprehend that these people are not peaceful. They refuse to admit that there are riots going on. There was even a liberal meme that they're trying to pass around this week, which it's not working anymore with how bad Portland is that they're claiming that all the violence happened in that last weekend of May. That there's not been any violence or rioting since, which is just boggles the mind, because in Seattle you had Chaz, where they took over, you know, an entire part of downtown, and there was battles with police there. There's been statue destruction all over the country. You know, there's been several bouts of violence in cities worse. I mean, the worst rioting, of course, nationwide happened in that last week of May, which that was the same week that George Floyd died. You know, Minneapolis was burning. Atlanta was having trouble. I mean, of course, Atlanta around that Wendy's where Rayshard Brooks, the great hero Rayshard Brooks, lost his life. They're seeing lots of violence there, lots of gunfire, lots of gang violence. That's, you know, hurt, you know, exacerbated the riot violence is already occurring. You know, we'll insist that there's no violence going on. And even in Seattle, when they took over that part of downtown, and, you know, Trump and Republicans were like, what's going on in Seattle? Why aren't you guys doing anything about this? This doesn't look good. The mayor went out like, they're having a summer of love. And of course, when the, you know, white Antifa there, like, began shooting blacks who were trying to invade their territory, then they're like, and they were seeing like videos of the protesters beating up journalists and stuff, then the mayor quietly like sent in the police to clear it up. But she never took back her summer of love tweets. And we're going to just keep seeing this, like, you know, Chicago and all these other cities are seeing like their violence skyrocket, and they cannot blame their antagonism of the police. They cannot blame their coddling of these minority communities who just want to cause chaos. They'll just like say that this is Trump's fault, or as AOC was saying, that they're wanting bread. That's why they're stealing shoes and setting courthouses on fire and shooting people. It's like this, they're just trying to feed their families, even though when, you know, the unemployment benefits right now being provided by the federal government are pretty good, and you shouldn't be stealing food right at this moment, depending on your circumstances, of course. But they have to rationalize this. And even when they're confronted with, you know, violence and these people burning down city streets, they'll just sit there and they'll blame Trump. They'll blame the federal government. They cannot blame these people. The BLM and Antifa are entirely blameless, and they can do whatever they want. This is the definition of anarcho-tyranny, which, if you were a normal citizen who decided to, you know, get in a scuffle with them, you would face like serious assault charges. Or if you're trying to drive your car and you had to like swerve around them, you'd face felony assault. But if, you know, if you want to tear down a statue or throw a Molotov cocktail at a federal agent, you're just a peaceful protester.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. And I mean, the whole charade of Ted Wheeler going out there and professing his support for these anarchists who are blatantly destroying the city he's supposed to, including government buildings, the city he's supposed to be.
And they hate him too.
Well, yeah, they do hate him. But I think it's just so, it's so fascinating that he still feels the need to go out there and voice his support for them, voice his opposition to President Trump. And I mean, that really just shows how power is wielded in this country, right? Just as you said, it's a narco tyranny. If the rabble out there didn't have the implicit, if not explicit, support of various elites, right? Big corporations, influential nonprofits, NGOs, politicians, you know, the most powerful, obviously the media, most powerful institutions and individuals in the country, then he wouldn't feel the need to do that. But the fact that he does, right, that just kind of reveals how things work. And these people, right, so again, does that mean that these neoliberal institutions and individuals are looking for the dictatorship of the proletariat? Are they interested in installing anarcho-communism? No, that means that their push for the centralization of power, you know, sees something to be gained from having these gutter punks out rioting in the streets and destroying property and things of that nature. So,
yeah. And one of the factors that is helping these riots is the media coverage, is that they all like, you know, they're all the same as like Ted Wheeler's. They'll say that there's like a largely peaceful protest. I think one of the most famous examples is that there was like an MSNBC reporter in Minneapolis, and there's a building burning right behind him, and he's like, this was largely a peaceful protest. It's like, there's a building that's engulfed in flames right behind you, and there's like a peaceful protest. And they did that with the same with Chaz. There was like several times where reporters were outside and like people in Chaz were trying to assault them and like were hurling insults and bottles. And like, yeah, we've only seen peaceful interactions here. This is entirely peaceful.
Right.
As they're doing their news report, it's like a water bottle is like careening past their head. you know, they'll just lie. And they're even doing this with like the defund the police movement. It's like, while we're seeing like crime rising, you know, to levels we haven't seen in 20 or 30 years, you know, they're still going forward with it. And like the media is saying, well, maybe defunding the police will help de-escalate this, will actually reduce crime, because what's causing all this crime is they're seeing all this police antagonism and there's over-policing their communities. And once they don't, like, they're just being triggered by police. And once they don't see police around, they'll stop committing crime, which, I mean, that's a bet they can take, but it's clearly not working, because, I mean, police presence is being reduced in these and many of the worst parts of these cities. A lot of police are just quitting their jobs because they're like, why am I doing this anymore if I'm just going to be sued and, you know, hit with like felony charges just for doing my job? Why do I want to do this job anymore? And everyone hates me. It's like, I can do better things with my life. And, you know, we're going to see this play out, and they'll just come up with the most ridiculous rationalizations for this, because they cannot undermine the moral thrust of Black Lives Matter. And by saying that, you know, they're acting too violent, or that, you know, actually, I mean, this also goes to the point when Minnesota's governor lied and said that all the violence in Minneapolis was caused by white nationalists. They cannot blame leftists for this. So they just went to their favorite boogeyman in order to get like a, you know, result out of it, of getting people to care. It's like, this is actually caused by white nationalism. So it exculpates blame from the actual people committing the violence and then puts it on the boogeyman, who then they can, you know, use more state power against and actually take action against the rioters and say that they're white nationalists. And they'll continue to do this over time. They'll just lie, and they have the power to lie. As we've seen with like media outlets claiming that, you know, going to a Black Lives Matter protest doesn't cause coronavirus yet, like eating at a restaurant outside is causing hundreds of thousands of people to get it, and we need to shut down the whole economy except for protests in order to stop the spread of corona. So, you know, the lies will only get worse as election season ramps up, and the violence will likely get worse as well. But we'll see more people like Ted Wheeler go out to the protests and insist against all evidence that there are no rioting going on. But a lot of Americans, unfortunately, support what the protesters are saying. 93% of Americans support police reform. The majority of Americans support Black Lives Matter, but there is a slight decline among whites for the movement. But the most interesting fact or study that we saw this week comes out that 50% of Americans think our country is racist. 51% of whites agree with that statement, and 66% of women agree with it. Ben Shapiro said he was devastated by this result. How did you react to it, Pat? Were you devastated and appalled that 56 Americans would think that America's racist?
I don't know if I'd say I'm devastated. I'm certainly a little disheartened, but it's not particularly surprising given the demographic trends in this country, given the fact that the ruling ideology is decidedly progressive, liberal, whatever you want to call it. So the fact that more and more people are buying into this stuff isn't, you know, it hasn't totally destroyed my world. I also don't know how actually upset about this Ben Shapiro is, but because let's keep in mind, he is on record as saying that, you know, actual racists, real racists, no, I think it was legitimate racists, which implies that there are illegitimate racists out there. But he said that legitimate racists deserve to be hunted and, you know, to have their jobs lost and whatever else. But yeah, it's how these things go. You know, when you have these big moments of cultural change, as we've seen in the last few months, I think most people are going to go along with it. There is going to be a counter reaction, but I don't think, we hear of the silent majority and whatever else. And I think that's somewhat of a cope. I think there are lots of people out there who are growing increasingly dissatisfied with the direction of the country, with Black Lives Matter, with Antifa, clearly. And yes, these people, due to the state of soft totalitarianism under which we live, these people can't come out openly without risking. And we've seen many of them do that, and they pay the price. And that creates an example for other people to shut up about it. So yeah, there are many people out there who are not happy with the way things are going. But the idea that those people are the majority, I don't, yeah, maybe a silent plurality or a silent, I don't know, a significant portion of the population, but like there's this huge majority of people out there who are against this. I don't think it's the case. This country is changing. And I think it's kind of a cope.
Yeah. But I actually would slightly disagree with you on Bidger. I think he actually is horrified by this because they believe that racism is an un-American feature. It's something that is a European import, that there was never racism, real racism in America, and that the majority of Americans always rejected racism. And this country is fundamentally anti-racist. And they build, Ben Shapiro and other conservatives build their ideology around this concept. And to see that the majority of Americans disagree with them, that no, America is racist, they're like, what? No, you have to see America as good and the greatest country ever. We're the exception, American exceptionalism. Like, how dare you believe this? And this does shatter their worldview and that. And also, they also like to insist, as you were pointing out, that most Americans aren't buying into this left-wing garbage, which, you know, that their own point is invalidated because a lot of these conservatives, I believe Ben Shapiro has mentioned that systemic racism is real. If he has not, several other prominent conservatives have said that systemic racism is real and Republicans must do something about it. Which, if you're saying systemic racism is real, then that would mean that America's racist and its foundations are racist. And you cannot be upset when the American population takes the logical, you know, step and says, okay, well, America is a racist country. You can't do anything about it. And they have too much cognitive dissonance going on for them to really have a coherent worldview and a coherent answer to this. Of course, I'm not, you know, appalled by it or shocked by it. I mean, the media tells Americans every day that there's systemic racism and blacks, if they just step outside their house, like a SWAT team will be there to mow them down. And that there's all these innocent blacks who are just being murdered and lynched. by both police and white racists that, you know, they've created this whole conception of how America is. So it's no surprise that like people who get their news from the newspapers and the nightly news would think that we're a racist country. You know, everything tells them that we're a racist country, from the university's education to the mainstream media. And this is just the natural result. I mean, I'm in some ways, I'm surprised that it's not higher. You know, and the poll that was taken was an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. They mentioned that an AP poll from 1988 said that 55% of Americans thought America, you know, had a racism problem. But it was considered a very different, like, I don't think that Americans then would have treated racism as something that the majority of people who were saying America was a racist country or had racism were not thinking that, you know, in terms of systemic racism, that our roots are racist or the foundations are racist. They would just say that there's a lot of racists in our country, which, you know, say what you will about that, that is something very different today, where they think that, you know, all our institutions are fundamentally biased against non-whites and we have to have a radical transformation to end this injustice. So I don't know if conservatives what to do in this situation, because they want to appease it and coddle it to a certain extent, and they want to change their views. And like Ben Shapiro is like, oh, you know, police racism is real. It's a problem. We need to deal with it. And then, you know, when it goes a little bit too far, you know, they're made very uncomfortable by it and they don't know how to respond. They could just say like America is like the freest, like least racist country in the world. At the same time, they're saying police racism is a major threat to our country and we must do something about it. So they have to pick or choose, and they're trying to have their cake and eat it, and it's not really working out for them.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that Ben Shapiro and his ilk do value the conception of America being kind of an anti-racist nation. As I think that's a necessary part of their worldview. And if that perception of America dissipates, then yeah, their whole shtick is kind of invalidated. So I think you are right about that.
And it goes to like, conservatives are defending the cringe musical Hamilton, which I would never put myself to ever listen to. Like, I already hate musicals in general. Listening to like a hip hop musical about the founders is like a bridge too far. I'd probably kill myself after the first 3 minutes of it. But they're trying to defend it as like this great thing because it teaches minorities to love America. But now the left is turning on it because they're like, the left is like, you're whitewashing all these racist white men as like black and Puerto Rican like hip hop artists who are, and the only white character or the only white actor in any Hamilton performance is King George the Third, which indicates that they were fighting against a white nationalist country, which, you know, doesn't really purport to history. So the conservatives are defending it as like, this is the real this is how we treat anti-racism, is that we imagine that the American founding is something that all people can see themselves in, because we now have this musical where they're rapping and they're black and Hamilton and George Washington are cool. And this is black kids. Don't you see? And they're all like, the black kids are like, no, these are a bunch of dead white men who owned slaves and wrote things about how we're inferior to white people. So no, we're not going to believe that. And there was a great tweet by Yasha Mook, who's this horrible neo-lib who writes at Slate and some other places, about how America can choose the anti-racism of Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, or they can choose the white anti-racism of Hamilton. And the left and the mainstream media are going with Robin DiAngelo's book, which is the number one seller right now. And she's raking in millions, telling white people that they're racist, even though she's a white person herself. Great scam she's running, but it's working. And now that's like our nation's religion. While Hamilton is being put to the side, in 5 years, we're all going to see Hamilton as the lamest thing that has ever happened. I support that. And it'll just be like goofy conservatives who are just like, we have to defend Hamilton. We must uphold Hamilton. We must show that the new Americans are just as American as the Anglos. And it's just not going to work. And, you know, conservatives are having a tough time understanding that immigrants and blacks and other non-whites are just not going to see themselves in the founders. They're going to see them as racist white men, and they're going to exploit America. I mean, they're fine with America as itself. It's a way for them to make money and to gain power, but they're not going to have this hagiography or have the same hagiography about this country that conservatives do. And conservatives don't know how to deal with this situation. You know, Hamilton is not the answer. Pat, I'm wondering if Pat is a big fan of Hamilton.
I'm staying quiet. Yeah, I'm staying quiet here. I'm a big Hamilton fan, and you know, I don't.
I'm sorry for offending you. You know, you've been probably been like, yeah, I love the part where he's like, immigrants get the job done, and they totally ignore that Hamilton wrote how we should have like an extremely strict immigration policy and shouldn't let hardly any immigrants in because they're going to come in and like corrupt our country with foreign ways, but. Like in Hamilton, he's turned into an immigration booster who thought that immigrants were superior to the natives, which I mean, yeah, Hamilton was technically an immigrant of English ancestry. Right. He was a Protestant who immediately fit into the colonies. He wasn't exactly coming from Ethiopia, but they turn him into like, oh, he's just like modern day immigrants. It's like, no, he was not. And he was like a strict immigration. He was an immigration restrictionist. And he wrote some actually based things on that topic. But they're trying to appeal to liberal biases. But even that won't save Hamilton.
Well, I just think it's, look, I might not agree with the politics of it, Scott. I just think it's a great, you know, as far as the arts are concerned, it's just a fantastic musical. And, you know, I might not agree with what they say, but I'll fight for their right to say it. So.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Speaking of fighting for people's right to say stuff, you know, moving on from Black Lives Matter, we need to talk about Uyghur Lives Matter. And no, it's not Uyghur Lives Matter, it's Uyghur. There's been a few, ironic posters out there who've tried to say that. When I say Uyghur Lives Matter, I say Uyghur Lives Matter. No, it's Uyghur. Don't you dare try to put words into my mouth. That's a warning to the irony posters out there. So final warning. But anyway, drone footage last week captured China loading up blindfolded Uyghurs onto trains, which drew widespread Western condemnation. But China may have stumbled onto an interesting way to defend its Uyghur policy, bringing up white genocide. The Chinese ambassador to Grenada said claims the declining Uyghur population amounts to genocide is like saying declining white birth rates is a genocide. I guess they've been listening to White Rabbit or something. But how do you think this line will work out in the West, Pat?
How do I think what will specifically will work out?
How will do you think that they're complaining if like the Chinese ambassador or Chinese officials saying that the Uyghur population is declining due to genocide or oppression is similar to saying in the West that declining white birth rates is due to intentional genocide from its government? How do you think that line will work out in the West?
I don't think it's going to be too well received. Even though he does, I believe in those tweets, he does say that he says, and we all know that's not happening, right? In relation to white genocide. So I don't know if he was being coy, if they maybe do think that that is happening over there, or if he's just trying to press, he knows which buttons to press to get under people's skin over here in America. I mean, you know, he did say that it's not happening.
Lack of awareness of like how the West work. I mean, they've like ambassadors have like done about like how like violent black neighborhoods are and how they like should avoid them. And he's like, you have so much crime, you must avoid it. And even when they were trying to support Black Lives Matter, like there's some Chinese video that said all lives matter. And it's like, that Black Lives Matter considers all lives matter now a hate crime. So that's clearly not going to work in the messaging. They really, I think that it like, we're so crazy that China cannot even figure us out. And they're just like pointing out that this like might work, but like they can't comprehend. Like, they're like, you have a declining white birth rate and you're clearly demographically, you know, you're bringing in immigrants to demographically replace them. And, you know, Western media, when they complain about what they're doing in Xinjiang, or I'm probably not even pronouncing it right, but that's where all the Uyghurs are, or in Hong Kong, where they're sending out ethnic Han Chinese and mainlanders to these areas to demographically swamp the native population. Western media outlets, like liberal outlets, will just like report this as like how terrifying it is, while like at the same time, like, celebrating it in the West. Like, yeah, we're replacing you. But the great replacement is a conspiracy theory. And I just think the Chinese can't really, like, comprehend how ludicrous this is. Like,
yeah.
Like, even with there's a viral interview that happened with the Chinese ambassador to the UK. He was, like, on BBC and was trying to defend it. And he really had, like, no way to defend it because he's, like, he had no language. He was just like, look, the Uyghurs are happy. They're having a happy life as he's like watching these guys who are like handcuffed and blindfolded being loaded up on a train. He's like, their life is great. It's like, I don't know how that's working. I've tweeted this out before that I think that what the Chinese could actually figure out how to counteract like all these worries about it is to say that one, the Uyghurs are white and they're racist towards the non-white Chinese, and that what's worse is how America treats its black population, that the real crime is American police violence against African Americans. And if they did this, first off, the Western media would not say, like, what does it matter if the Uyghurs are white? Like, this is still oppression and ethnic cleansing. They would not go to that regard. They would insist, like, violently insist that the Uyghurs are not white because they don't want to defend, like, a white people from being oppressed by a non-white people. Like, they don't. They would put them on a media back foot where all the articles would be outlining how the Uyghurs are non-white, which would also undermine their whole claims that race is a made-up category. It's like, who's to say the Uyghurs can't be white? What if they feel that they're white? Like, why can't they be white? And then they would just go to these resurrect Madison Grant and Lothrop's daughter to defend their point that the Uyghurs are not white, that they're Asiatic. And second, if the Chinese said that that's what happening to blacks is far worse than what's happening to Uyghurs, the media would not know what to do, because if they said that's what happening to the Uyghurs is worse, then that would totally undermine Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
They do not want to get in that argument at all. It would entirely put the media and the Western leaders on a back foot, and they would just like be stumbling around. It's like, police racism is bad, but we need to worry about the Uyghurs. And if they just did that, like, and they would probably get Black Lives Matter leaders on the record. It's like, yeah, that's right. Like, what happened? Police stopping us is far worse than stop and frisk is far worse than being loaded up onto a train. Like, they would make this argument. So I think. But the Chinese, like, could effectively weaponize woke culture to their benefit. But I don't think the officials really comprehend it or know how to use this. And this is, it would be a very amusing and entertaining, but it's like a good thing that they don't know how to use this, because, in the future, that can mean very bad things. And I don't necessarily, want, like, all Western idiots like supporting China are their point of view, but they don't really know how to effectively weaponize it. So it is, like, in some points good, but if they did learn how to weaponize it and figure out what motivates our journalists and our leaders and how to portray their own issues in terminology that they cannot resist or effectively refute, that, like, people would overnight stop caring about the Uyghurs, because they would. Like, you cannot say that what's happening to blacks is less worse than what's happening to Uyghurs. You can't say that. I mean, that, and that's the fact of the matter. I mean, you could say, maybe you could say it's equal, but you cannot say it's not as big of a deal.
Yeah, it's a very interesting comparison. I think my take on the Uyghur situation is, from what I've looked into, everything that's happened there in the last few years, it does. I mean, it does seem pretty bad. It seems.
Yeah, it is bad. Like, I don't like.
Yeah.
Nobody. I don't think anyone will disagree. That's what's
sure.
Happened.
Sure. But yeah, my position on it is the same as most other, most things happening outside of the sphere of American influence, is that I just don't care. It's like Hong Kong versus mainland China too. It's not that I have aside there, it's that I don't. I resent the fact that I am being forced or, pressured to choose a side. As an American, you have, the media support coming out in support of Hong Kong, and I get both sides. I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to both sides. I just don't want to have to care. On the one hand, yeah, the fact that you have these multinational corporations going along with China is cause for concern from a free speech perspective, sure. But on the other hand, you're not going to get me excited over the prospects for a, you know, color revolution or regime change in Hong Kong. So it's the Americans have really nothing to gain from siding with either side in this particular conflict. And moreover, I would add that we have this, our ruling class has been doing this for some time, and that's scapegoating foreign entities, individuals, phenomena as the source of America's ills, right? This goes back to the war on terror. Oh, we fight them over there, so we don't have to fight them here. It's Saddam Hussein. He's the real threat to, you know, some guy in Columbus, Ohio's, safety and his family's well-being. What you have is the ruling class just basically getting you to worry about stuff outside of America. And that occludes the fact that the things that we need to be concerned about, right, the biggest and the most severe threats to the American people are at home. Just this distraction, the constant distraction. Now China is becoming increasingly one, but only in a regime approved way, right? If you're concerned about tariffs or something, oh well, that's never going to work, and you're probably a Nazi who supports Donald Trump. So
yeah,
it's just it's also tiresome, as the saying goes, but. I just resent in general having to being expected to feel strongly one way or the other on this. So,
yeah, and a lot of the arguments that they make to make us care about Hong Kong, it's different from the Uyghurs, because I mean, what's happening to the Uyghurs is far worse than what's happening in Hong Kong. Is that they use arguments of stuff that's already happening here in our countries to complain it's happening in Hong Kong. Like, there was an NPR journalist this week who was like terrified. He's like, financial services are denying our financial like institutions are denying service to Hong Kong dissidents. Like, how terrible this is. They're using political views as a reason to deny them service. And it's like, this is already happening in the West. As you can attest, as AIM got removed by its bank account, by its bank. Our previous guest, Martin Sellner, has been rejected by 19 banks in Austria. And there's several other people. And if you use the big picture of financial institutions, like, very few people in the dissident right can use PayPal. Stripe, many people have been kicked off Stripe. A lot of people can't use Patreon or Subscribestar or any of these financial services that they need to survive. And yet the Western media will complain about Hong Kongers losing it because of their political views. It's like, this is already happening in the West. Like, it's bad what's happening to Hong Kongers, but I'm worried about what's happening to our people more. Like, that's already happening here, and they have to complain about, like, oh, Hong Kong no longer has free speech. It's like, we really don't have that much in like the West, and like the UK is like wanting to grant special exemptions, a refugee status for Hong Kongers because they're losing their freedom. And I was like, the UK like throws people in jail for like Facebook posts. They arrested a 12-year-old for criticizing a soccer star. This is happening in the UK. It's bad what's happening in Hong Kong, but that's already happening in our countries. There's no self-awareness for a lot of these Hong Kong complaints. And it's like, frankly, I'm worried about our own issues more. And neocons always try to, you know, create these sob stories. And it's not really just like neocons, it's liberals in general, because woke militarism is the one guiding principle of our nation's elite. And they always use these sob stories about like, oh, the Taliban is oppressing women in Afghanistan. That's why we have to stay there. And Saddam Hussein is oppressing his minorities, and that's why we have to topple him. And Assad, you know, he does terrible things to, to Sunnis. And they always use these stories. And it's like, you know what? Bad things happen in the world. We don't necessarily approve of it, but we have bigger concerns. And there's not really like a general like solution or policy agenda to do against China, because a lot of the people who are the loudest voices crying over the Uyghurs and Hong Kong oppose tariffs to China. And it's like we're trying to hurt the Chinese economy that's oppressing these people, but for some reason you must have your cheap iPhone, you must have your cheap products, you cannot put tariffs on China. So what do you propose? It's like, oh, we issue a strong denunciation. yeah, that's really going to convince the Chinese to stop throwing Uyghurs in concentration camps. So there's no real solution to this. And it's, you know, except for forcing the NBA to sell customizable free Hong Kong jerseys, which is really important to me. I demand my Los Angeles Lakers free Hong Kong jersey, which some, for some reason conservatives care more about than, you know, Black Lives than the NBA supporting Black Lives Matter. And I think for a lot of ways, as conservatives are directing a lot of this nationalist anger toward China, like when, you know, coronavirus is happening, I was like, you know, very supportive of the anti-China stuff, because the alternative was just to blame Trump entirely for this, rather than like the whole government system we've had for the last 40 years that's outsourced our manufacturing to China and it's connected our corporations and our economy so heavily with China. We're instead just going to blame Trump entirely on this. And that was the alternatives. And it's a lot of ways, like China was responsible for the coronavirus getting out. You know, maybe in our government didn't necessarily respond as sufficiently as they should have to this menace, but we cannot say that China did a great job, and you must blame China. And due to our independence and interconnectedness with China, that this whole virus became a problem for us. We have to admit that. But I think right now, with like what we're seeing with the unrest and Black Lives Matter and Antifa waging war on our heritage, on our very society, and trying to make whites second-class citizens, I think, you know, turning all of our anger and focus onto China is silly and doesn't address the real problems. And I think the right, you know, it's like China's not good. We shouldn't want them to become the world power. But, you know, they're going to probably, you know, if like we're already saying that we should stay in Afghanistan to prevent China from taking over. It's like, you know what? Every country, there have been several empires who tried to take over Afghanistan. It's not worked for any of them. Let the Chinese take on Afghanistan. Good luck. You know, well, I'm sure it'll have the same result as the Soviets trying to take it over in the 80s. So, you know, and that's
we've gained virtually nothing from the, you know, what, trillions of dollars we've spent in Afghanistan. Something, let them go get it, you know, entrench themselves in a quagmire. It's not, oh no, they're going to get Afghanistan. Wow.
Yeah, no, we must keep Afghanistan. Civilizational boon. They're going to take away the women's rights there. You know, they use all these cringe arguments. So a lot of this anti-China stuff supports the American empire's stupid foreign interventions and like stupid policies. And then also a lot of this anti-China stuff is a lot of the arguments for the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that we must do this in order to stifle China's economic growth. And we have to send all our jobs to the Vietnam and all these Southeastern Asian countries. And it's like, well, how does the American worker benefit from that? It's like, maybe that's okay. Maybe China's economy's hurt, but that's just supporting more globalism. So
right,
people need to keep in focus on what's important. And I think a lot of the China stuff is just a distraction. But, you know, moving on to our final topic, we're moving on to the highly respected patron question segment of the show. And as a reminder, you can ask questions too if you sign up for the Patreon option at Highly Respected's Patreon. This one comes from Tony. Tony asks, Scott, you talk a lot about polling in the election and say Trump's chances against Biden look slim, but the polls were totally wrong in 2016. Why are you believing the polls now? Well, I'm not entirely believing the polls, but I think you have to look at how the polls were in 2016 versus now. 2016, they would change rapidly over a week. Like there'd be one week where Trump was up 1 point by 1 point. Then the next week, Hillary would be up by 5 points. And then it just like kept, you know, changing. And there was many times where Trump was ahead on the Real Clear Politics average. There's not been a time where Trump has been ahead of the Real Clear Politics average. And for the past 2 months, Biden has been about, you know, 8 to 10 points ahead in the average. This isn't just like polls, like one poll. This is the average, which takes like 7 or 8 polls that are released a week. And it's been a pretty clear Biden is doing much better than Hillary was in 2016. Now, that doesn't mean that Biden's got this wrapped up, like the election's over. You should, you know, the polls right now mean how it's going to be on election day. A lot can change, but this is a very different election from 2016, and people shouldn't necessarily believe that, okay, the polls were wrong in 2016. That means they're going to be wrong again in 2020. you know, if you're looking at the messaging, is Trump had a lot of energy and momentum in 2016. He was campaigning against the swamp, against the establishment that was embodied by Hillary Clinton. Now he's the incumbent president, though there's chaos in the streets. Coronavirus is still there. Our economy isn't doing so well. Like, people are afraid. People want a return to normalcy. And Biden is promising a return to normalcy. And I've said this in podcasts before, is that Trump has a serious messaging problem. Like, it's not clear what he wants this election to be about. They're trying to do socialism first freedom, but like, it's Joe Biden. If you ask Joe Biden if he's a socialist, he's like, no, I hate socialism. I love capitalism. That issue would be over in a minute. You know, they're trying to pretend he's Bernie because they know that Biden, they can't really fearmonger about him. You know, they're trying to do stuff about like, this is Biden's America, where they're showing all the chaos is happening. Now, that's a better message than socialism versus freedom, but right now it's Trump's America. The better messaging they are trying to do is like saying, like, under Biden, there's going to be defunding police and robbers can break into your home and you call 911 and no one will answer. There's like a very effective ad where there's an old lady who's watching her TV and seeing chaos, and then a robber's breaking into her home and she's trying to get a hold of 911. And it's like, sorry, we can't reach you because we've been defunded. That's a very effective ad. So there's some ways that they're, you know, figuring this out. But Trump is, you know, he's in trouble. He needs to take this seriously. People cannot just say that right off the polls. The one thing I will say in favor of the people who don't want to believe the polls is that the election, or especially the polls and how they're assessing the election, the electoral demographic will look, may be wrong just because coronavirus, you know, that could impact people whether they want to go. And more Democrats are less willing to go to the polls than Republicans are due to coronavirus fears. And you know, the turnout that the polls are expecting could be totally wrong. And the demographics, and also in battleground states, Trump's numbers aren't that bad. You know, he's leading in a lot of states. People where you think he's going to lose, Arizona and Texas, most polls still show him ahead or only 1 or 2 points behind. He could still win in Wisconsin, and he's probably definitely going to win in Ohio and Florida. You know, he may lose Michigan and Pennsylvania, but he can still lose those states and possibly win. And there's even a chance he may win Nevada, depending on how coronavirus, or even Minnesota, if Minneapolis turns into Mad Max Fury Road, like other Minnesotans be like, Biden's going to turn all cities into like this. So maybe we'll vote for Trump. So there are some things that can change. But I think, you know, people need to be taking this more seriously about Trump's polling numbers and not being, say, like, oh, in 2016, the polls were totally wrong. Actually, in 2016, they weren't entirely wrong. Like, the RCP average put Hillary Clinton a little over 3 points ahead of Trump nationwide. She won the popular vote by 2 points. So they're like a 1 point off. You know, people just didn't expect the states to turn out how they were going to be. So Pat, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think people have not critically compared the polling data from 2016 to 2020. Yes, there were a number of polls that showed Donald Trump was very behind Hillary Clinton all throughout 2016, some as recently as a few weeks leading up until the election. Yeah, I mean, the one CNN poll showed Donald Trump at 3%. What was that, the week of the election, maybe the night of the election? So yeah. People are absolutely justified in taking these polls with a grain of salt, but that doesn't mean you discount them altogether. And again, as you pointed out, the polling is far worse this time around than it was back in 2016. If you just go to Real Clear Politics, look at the average, look at the list of polls, national polls, and I don't think you can find a single one that shows that Donald Trump has the lead over Biden. You can find a few individual states where he might have the advantage, but they're in states that you would expect him to have the advantage. When it comes to national polls, right, the president is far behind. And as you said, in many of these polls too, he has behind by double digits, right? Biden has a double digit lead. So there's a lot that could happen between now and November, but November draws ever nearer, and all of the strange, unforeseen providential things that happened this year, as opposed to 2016, have worked out decidedly to Trump's disadvantage. So I'm not, you know, packing it up. I'm not ready to move to Poland or something. But but at the same time, yeah, it's
I'm moving to Kyrgyzstan, by the way.
It's not looking good. So
Yeah, I actually have the my Kekistan backup option if he loses. So
Somewhere
I'm going to go there. Yeah. Rent is actually pretty cheap there. But the one difference, and another difference I want to point out is I've said this before, is that, you know, it's a very different feeling to this election, is that Trump had these large rallies. There's a tons of energy. And even though a lot of people on the distant right were like, well, our sphere of Twitter isn't that excited, but a lot of the boomers are, but they're not able to express it through the rallies due to coronavirus. And they're, and the media knows that the rallies, you know, help Trump. And that's why whenever, you know, in the Tulsa rally, they warned that anyone who goes is just going to die. There's going to be a mass like deaths. It's going to be like the Black Plague coming. And that did lower like numbers to a degree. And Trump, you know, is worried about filling up his auditoriums, and he doesn't want to have these rallies. And he knows that it's, you know, not the best optics for, you know, to have these rallies if there's like a coronavirus upsurge. So he's not having that same energy in the, like this, you know, upstart revolution that he had in 2016. But at the same time, and if, you know, this is also something I want to say before, but I need to insist, you know, for the people who are like, oh, you're being blackpilled, or some people actually think I'm being cocked if I'm like saying that Trump might win. So it depends on your listener's stance. But one thing to consider is that Biden has like hardly any enthusiasm for him. Like the enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, people complained about how there wasn't much enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, but the enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton in 2016 was like Obama in 2008 compared to Biden. Like nobody on earth is excited to vote for Biden. And many people, if they think that they're going to get corona if they go to vote for Biden, will just stay home and be like, well, the polls are telling me Biden's got this in the bag, so why do I need to risk my life or to go and vote for Biden? So there are some things. It's like, I don't think, and the Biden infrastructure isn't as strong. He's not raising nearly as much money as Hillary was. You know, there's, even with coronavirus, there's problems with getting out the vote efforts. So there's still, this election's still in play. The polling could be wrong. But if it's still like Biden by 9 or 10 points ahead in October, I think, you know, it's 98% certain that Biden will win, even though people will complain. The New York Times said that Hillary had a 97% chance. I think this time it's a little bit more accurate. But that is all the time we have today on Highly Respected. Pat, you've been censored a lot, as we've said before. Big tech is oppressing you. So how can people find you and support you?
Sure. So I can be found on Telegram, t.me/PatrickCaseyUSA. Additionally, I'm on Parler, PatrickCaseyUSA. I
don't Parlay, know. Actually.
is that what it's called?
It actually, what the dumbest thing is that it's a site dedicated to boomers, but it's a French word and it's pronounced Parlay. But of course, none of its users call it Parlay.
Yeah, I've never heard it called Parlay. Yeah, that's trying to be a little too highbrow for probably the average person who's going to use it. I think it's at PatrickCaseyUSA on there too. I don't really use it that often. So yeah, Telegram, also DLive. I stream from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, sometimes on the weekends too. And that's DLive.tv/PatrickCasey. So that mostly does it. I may or may not be on Twitter, but if I am, I'm flying under the radar, so we won't go into what my username would
be. Okay, well, we won't dox your Twitter account on here.
That's right, we won't. But I'm,
yeah, but I, anyway, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. We'll have to have you on again. Maybe you'll have your Twitter account back again. We'll have to see.
We'll see. Anyway, yeah, well, thank you for having me on, Scott.
Yeah, thank you. And until next time, stay respected.